You heard it here first, guys. Racism is bad for everyone.
Exactly. But I think it's just important to remember that fact. It's like the AI is not the problem. The AI is a reflection of a profoundly unequal society.
Welcome to Signal, the podcast that raises your frequency. I'm Maury Fontanez.
And I'm Melissa Grushka.
And today we have a very special guest here to talk to us about AI and bias. Mean, are you ready?
Very ready.
Hey, Signal listeners, happy summer. We hope that you're enjoying the weather, the sun, that you have plans to enjoy your summer. Bean and I are going to do the same. So we are taking a summer hiatus and we'll be back with new episodes of Signal starting in September. We hope you enjoy this final episode of the season with Dr. Epps. It's a fascinating conversation about AI and the biases that exist in AI. So we thought we'd go out on a high note for this season and we can't wait to come back with all new episodes in September. See you then. Hi, Bean.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Epps.
Hello.
We are so excited to be joined by Dr. Avriel Epps. Dr. Epps is a computational social scientist, an educator, and a strategist, really, whose work bridges artificial intelligence and the well-being of youth and transformative justice. Did I get that right?
That's right. That's
quite
it.
The mission that you have.
Agreed. And quite the brilliant mission at that.
Yeah. And I have to say, we've been watching your content and so many light bulbs going off for me around the bias that exists in AI. So we're really excited for you to turn on some light bulbs for us and our listeners, because if you don't know, you don't know until someone tells you, hey, you need to be looking out for this stuff. But before we get into all that good stuff, someone's warned you that we like to play a little cringe and delight so we can get to know how each other's week has gone. And we love for our guests to go first. So do you have anything delightful or embarrassing to share with us from your week?
Yeah, I have a pretty embarrassing thing to share on the topic of
today. We love when it's embarrassing.
Just happened yesterday. So I'm in the process right now at my child's elementary school of building a pledge with all of the other families in kindergarten to not give our children phones before the eighth grade, keep them off of social media until well into high school, and to do like phone-free play dates, all of the things. And I was at dinner yesterday with one of the co-authors, co-organizers of that pledge, and our kids. And my kid starts having a meltdown at the pizza shop. Like, why can't I play Zen Coloring, which is his like favorite game on my phone?
How old is your kid? Tell us.
He's six. He was like, you always let me play, even on weeknights, even on school nights. Like, I was like,
keep it down, kid.
It's not true.
You're like, why are you such a liar?
I'm just like, oh my God, here I am trying to tell all the other parents to like not give their kids screen time, and mine's telling them that I let him spend hours on my phone. So anyway, that was my crutch for the week.
You know what? Kids always do it to you, man. They just say the stuff out loud in front of everyone. This has happened
He really be lying on me. Also,
I know. They are little rats.
And I feel like it makes you a really great guest for this, being that real. Like, we don't want to hear that you're perfect and your kid is never on the screen and everything is, you know, all
mine. Absolutely.
We like it a little sloppy over here too.
Right. Then we feel bad about ourselves.
Parenting is sloppy.
So sloppy.
Oh, gosh.
Speaking of sloppy.
Oh, emo. Here we go. We have kids home from school today. Hi. Oh, my God. What a gorgeous child.
I can't hear.
I know you can't hear, but I'm working right now, so I need some time, okay?
Okay.
Can you please go back outside?
I'm done with this skateboard.
Okay. You can go do something else, but I need to work for the next hour.
What can I do?
Play on my phone.
I hear you. You can go play outside or go play with the other kids. Those are your options.
What can I stand here?
Because I need to work.
Can I go with
it? No, I need you to go outside.
Do I need to go outside?
Yes.
I'm just going to get something and I'm going to do it quietly.
Okay. All right.
I would have just loved for you to say, go get on your iPad. That would have been so perfect. Come on, please.
We were waiting for it.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, Bean, do you got a cringe or a delight for us quickly?
Me?
Yes. Do you have a quick cringe?
I have a delight, even though I honestly prefer cringes very much so, but I have a very lovely delight. Whenever there's any like glimpse for me of like humanity left in the world these days, I like cling to it as much as I can. I was turning yesterday. I was on my way to an appointment. I went to go left. I looked to my right. It's a very busy road outside my neighborhood. And there's like a tiny little black dog running up the road. I mean, like, and barreling. And if it ran into the road, it was a goner. And I see the older woman following it behind. And I'm like, it's pouring rain. I'm like, I got to get out and help. I pull over. I get out. Then two cars pull over and they start and they get real close to each other and they sort of follow the dog while me and the woman are chasing it to prevent it from running out into the road. And as it would move up, they would both move up. So like all these people stopped in the middle of their day just to help this woman in the rain get her dog back. And it really touched my heart.
That is sweet. Did she get the dog?
I got the dog. Yes.
You got the dog. Yes. Oh, of course you did. I knew you got the dog. I could have said that. That's sweet. You know what? I agree with you. I'm looking for
pockets.
Humanity everywhere these days because I'm so devastated all the time.
I know. Me too.
So it's really lovely to see when people are kind to each other. All right. Well, I'm going to round things out with my cringy cringe. We are now, Dr. Epps, we're now recording every other week. So we don't get to tell each other these stories as often as we used to, but I've been holding on to this one. So I did this mother-daughter duet with my daughter. I'm terrified of singing, like terrified. And she is a singer. Am I being biased, Bean?
No way I'm biased here, Doc.
So I wanted to show her that one, I wanted to do the thing that she loves with her, and two, that fear wasn't going to hold me back. So this voice coach in our area was like, I'm doing this mother-daughter thing at this restaurant with a stage, 10 mother-daughters. Will you join? I said, yes. We pick. Do you want to guess what song we would have picked that is so appropriate for a mother-daughter duet? We pick The Boy Is Mine by Brandy and Mark.
It's gross.
That's not the cringe part.
Who picked
That's
it?
That's not the cringe part. I think we were talking about songs, and I think I said, Raina, wouldn't it be so funny if we did The Boy Is Mine? And she's like, yes. And her eyes lit up. And I was like, well, now we just got to do it because it's hilarious. So we were like literally singing The Boy Is Mine. But anyway, this is the best part. I was so nervous that we sat down at this restaurant, and as we were waiting to go, our friend was there and he kept pouring me wine. I kept drinking it because I was like, I'm nervous. I can't. So I'm, you know, I get up there. I do a fine job. It's whatever. I sit back down. I'm still drinking. She was great.
It was
anyway, at the end of the show, the woman who put it on brought her mom up to do a duet with. So now the woman who put this show on is probably my age. So she's like in her mid-40s. The mom looked like she was 40. So we were all blown away. We were like, who is this lady? They do the thing. They sit down. By the end of this, I've probably had half a bottle of wine, if not more.
Nice.
We go to say goodbye. I walk up to this lady, the mom of the voice coach. I don't know what the hell happened in my brain or why
alcohol.
I thought it was appropriate
alcohol.
To say. But I was like, you were amazing. She's like, oh my God, thank you. And I was like, and how can this be your daughter? She's like, oh my God, thank you. I'm like, what did you do? Kill a princess and drink her blood? Literally, it just came out of my mouth. Like, yes, that is the thing, Dr. F. Where did that come from?
Where did that come from?
It was like I think I had like Rapunzel in my head. I don't know. And the best part is my 16-year-old is standing behind me and she's like, we got to go now. And she like pushes me out the door. We get outside. She's like, mom, what the hell?
At least in Rapunzel, she sucks her energy. She doesn't even drink her blood. This was like Dracula.
That's next
level. Yeah.
It's wild.
It's giving sinners.
It's giving. Exactly. So with that. I had to tell that story here. Enough of our nonsense. You have a book out, a kid's book about AI bias. And it's really about educating younger audiences on the ethical implications of AI. Can you just tell us what does that mean exactly and why? Why have you devoted your life and your career to this?
Thank you for that question. There's a bunch of different ways we can think about the ethics of AI. And I mean, there it ranges from everything from like, how do we build AI that doesn't kill us all, which is not the angle I take because I'm not entirely sure that that's something that's really a future possibility, to, you know, how do we keep AI from harming real people right now, which is really what I'm focused on. And so when I think about AI harms that are harming folks right now, it's typically the folks who are marginalized in our society, people of color, women, children, folks with disabilities, et cetera, et cetera. And so one of the ways that AI harms marginalized people is by having certain biases baked into it that negatively impact those folks. So we can think about things like facial recognition technology that's used by law enforcement that's really bad at accurately detecting faces of color or women's faces. And then that leads to things like wrongful arrests or false criminalization. Or we can think about recommendation systems on social media and how they might be biased toward different ideological slants or might send certain types of content to certain types of users that reinforces existing forms of harm. And maybe a good example of this would be, let's say, social media tends to send anorexia content to young girls. And that is a group of people who suffers disproportionately from that disease. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I care about this topic because it is not some far off distant thing that might hurt humanity one day.
Right.
It is the type of stuff that machine learning and artificial intelligence is already doing to the most vulnerable people in our society. And in studying this topic, one of the kind of glimmers of hope that I and others are starting to look at is like, well, how can we make people more resilient to some of these types of biases when they encounter them? And we think that early critical digital literacy might be a sort of vaccine or some kind of like inoculation or something that buffers against some of the most negative effects of these systems. And so, you know, my hypothesis, my theory is that if we can write books for kids as young as kindergarten, preschool age, that help people start to gain a sense that this is a systemic problem. It's a problem with the technology. It's not a problem with me when I encounter it. There's nothing wrong with me that my algorithm feeds me this thing or that the police are showing up in my neighborhood more often because they're using predictive policing tools that are racist or classist. Then we can start to protect the youngest and the most vulnerable in our society against some of those harms.
Wow.
Can I ask what might be a naive question? Is why is the AI algorithm sending anorexia to, how did it get itself geared towards that age group?
I don't think that's a naive question at all. I think that's still an open question in science. The problem is that a lot of these platforms that have developed these recommendation systems specifically, which is a different type of AI than like ChatGPT or the kinds of AI that folks might be thinking about, is that there are these closed systems behind, you know, like corporate controlled black box systems. So we actually
have no idea.
Outside researchers don't have access to the data to even answer that question. And we do our best sometimes to try to audit from the outside, but it doesn't tell a complete picture. So I don't think anybody fully understands, or actually not anybody, but us on the outside don't fully understand. And potentially folks on the inside of these companies don't really know why either.
So when you talk about educating younger audiences, what are some examples, maybe from your book, about how you're teaching them to look for what? What specifically can they learn from the book and just from your work to prepare?
I mean, there's a couple of different examples in the book. We talk about a piece of technology that I think a lot of young people are probably familiar with, which is selfie filters. Mm-hmm. So when you're on like Snapchat or Instagram or something, and you're using facial recognition to detect that there's even a face in the frame, and then potentially some other kind of generative AI system that puts a different face on top of yours. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking specifically in this about like the real beauty filter on TikTok. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but
yeah.
It's like this really insane makeup filter mm-hmm. that works really well and changes your face quite dramatically. Anyway, and so, you know, but if you're reading the book with your kid, it could even be something that like changes their face into a dinosaur, right? Like those kinds of selfie filters exist too. And so first I just try to demystify that and be like, this is a form of machine learning on some level. It is using all the information it has about millions of faces in a data set that has trained this model to mm-hmm. then detect where the different features of your face are so that it can then change them to the effect in this filter. And for some people, those selfie filters deform their faces, or for some selfie filters deform their faces to, you know, they lighten their skin, they change yeah. their eye color to be green or blue. They, you know, in extreme cases, there's some TikTok filters that I've tried out recently that just like straight up turned me into a blonde lady.
I saw the video that you posted of the filters you were using and how it was progressively getting whiter and whiter.
Yeah, it was really wild. I was using different AI filters on TikTok. But yeah, there was one that it was like a Barbie filter and it's supposed to turn you into a Barbie character. And mine turned me into like blonde, blue-eyed Barbie. And
wow.
I was like,
wow,
there's a lot of other Barbies I could have been turned really? Into.
Wow.
And then, yeah, that's a good example. That's a experiment. I also put out a card game, like an interactive card game to go along with the book that folks can just print out and download for free.
Yeah.
That runs children through a series of different experiments. That being one of them, but also things like go to Google search and type in famous computer scientists or famous business people, non-gendered words or titles, and then see what the results are. And they tend to be pretty gendered, as you can imagine. and then, you know, go to ChatGPT and ask it to generate a picture of an American, and do that a bunch of times and see, you know, what does it consistently give you?
Yeah.
Just so they can get in the habit of observing what happens and not just passively consuming and saying, oh, this is the right answer, mm-hmm. but instead think critically about what patterns am I detecting here and why might that be the case.
Was your focus always on youth, or was it more since you had a child that you really started thinking in that towards that generation?
That's a great question. I have always been interested in youth. My early research was adolescent focused, but like adolescence, young adulthood. And I more recently have been interested in development kind of across the lifespan. And specifically for young folks who are kind of the first AI natives in our society. And that just happens to be my child's generation.
Yeah.
But I also, I'm working on research projects right now that look at how recommendation systems shape sociopolitical identity in older people around contentious issues, like, you know, a whole host of bad things that are happening in the world.
We were both like...
So not, you can take your pick, right? You don't have to talk about any one of them, but
it's all of them.
Exactly. So yeah, I think my interest is just, you know, how do these systems shape people differently depending on what developmental stage they're in?
Right.
Right. Early childhood, maybe adolescence, maybe later in life, right?
Yeah.
That's where my curiosity lies.
Let's talk about the shaping for a minute. I mean, I think a lot of it's implied and we can assume, but can you explicitly share what is the psychological impact of this AI bias on younger people?
Yes. Yeah, I think we cannot conclusively say what the impact is. The research, my research on this is still very early. There's some evidence to suggest that there might be negative mental health impacts along the lines of like increased anxiety, you know, p- PTSD, potentially increased depression when you encounter these things. We know anecdotally that in the most extreme cases of these kinds of AI harms, like say, you know, facial recognition technology falsely incriminating you, that that has profound, long-lasting life impacts, right? Mm-hmm. What happens to an individual when a police officer shows up to your door and says, you've done a crime that you've never done, and says, I'm going to go arrest you. You've lost your job. Potentially you lose your housing. You know, your children might lose learning time that can't be made up, right? There's all kinds of cascading effects of that. But in the aggregate, we're still trying to wrap our heads around that. Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, there's a whole literature out there about the impacts of screen time generally mm-hmm. and social media on young people. And lots of folks kind of rushing to conclusions that social media is causing, you know, the mental health epidemic in young people right now. And I've looked at a lot of that evidence, and honestly, that's still pretty inconclusive.
Right.
The problem is, yeah, because we don't, different studies are saying different things. Folks are coming to different conclusions. And we don't have a wealth of kind of gold standard experimental data that would conclusively say this causes that. That makes sense if you think about it intuitively, yeah. because in order to run an experiment, you have to like separate a group of people. You have to have two comparable groups of people, get one getting social media, one not getting social media, and then track them over a long time. It's still pretty early. I think it's as a parent, as somebody who's kind of watching this debate unfold in the field, I am just a more cautious person. So I am personally like, I'll wait and keep my kid off of social media because I don't know. We don't know yet. Right. And the results are mixed. But I think anybody who is like, we know for sure that this is what's happening, and therefore you have to keep your kids off social media at all costs because it's as bad for them as smoking cigarettes or doing drugs or whatever. I don't know. I'm a little skeptical of those folks.
When I think about just the bias that AI presents, and I kind of map that to the relationship of identity. For me, what I talk a lot about is like the media we grow up with in this mm-hmm. country, in the US, and as people of color, the identity issues that that creates and has created for me specifically. You know, for example, growing up in the 80s, watching television and watching mostly white upper middle class families, for example, and then comparing my family, comparing myself, and the assimilation that resulted from that exposure. Is there a parallel with AI bias in the potential impact it has on identity of people of color?
You know, you're asking such an important question, because in that conversation that we were just having about social media and mental health effects, I think what we're missing is kind of the larger context of what might else be causing young people to feel anxious and depressed. And similarly, racism across all facets of society has profound negative health impacts on people of color, and compounded that with having other marginalized identities, like being a woman or being a disabled person or being a young person.
Right.
And so the answer to your question is racism is bad for people and technology is just another tool in the racist toolkit.
Yeah, you heard it here first, guys. Racism is bad for everyone. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it's just important to remember that fact. It's like the AI is not the problem. It is that the AI is a reflection of a profoundly unequal and inequitable society, and it might be exacerbating that problem.
Yeah.
But it's a symptom, it's not the root disease.
Well, it's such an important point, because I think we believe that we're evolving and technology is evolving. And we see sometimes we can fall into the trap as seeing technology as neutral or robotic. So I think what's so important and masterful about the way you talk about this work is this is also influenced by systems and structures and culture. And so if it's been created in a racist society, then the technology itself also has this inherent racism to it. And that is a light bulb. I feel like if you walk away from this episode with nothing else, that is, for me, what's most important, is to know that we have to be watching technology for our kids as another way of implanting racist ideas. You did this, obviously, I was on your Instagram a lot, but you did this post where you asked ChatGPT to show you pictures of an American. Can you just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the experiments in that free game that everyone on the, listening to the podcast, if you don't buy the book, at least go download the game so you can like do something disturbing and kind of fun with your kid on a Friday night, I guess.
That's what we all love to do.
Exactly. But yeah, the first experiment in that game is to ask ChatGPT to generate a picture of an American and ask it 10 times. And you know, it's interesting because I think if you had done that experiment, there's a couple of things. One is that every time we do this experiment, as time goes on, we're going to get different results because the models are constantly updating. Right. OpenAI is constantly trying to attempt to correct for some of the things that people are calling it out for. So I think if we had asked that question a year ago, it would have just been like white person after white person after white person. Mm-hmm. That was not the case, at least last month when I did it. But there was a mix of, you know, a couple of black guys and there might've been like an Asian woman, but it was interesting because all the people had the same face. It was like, they were swapping out the racial features and the like hair, but
the same face, just slightly different color or gender.
Exactly. Yeah. And they all had the same blue or red shirt on. And there was always an American flag in the background.
Yeah.
It was really weird. But there were no elderly people. There was nobody with any visible disabilities. There were no children. That's what my kids recognized at first. They're like, wait a minute. All of these people are just like middle-aged adults. And I was like, you are right. That is true. And that's so fascinating. Why do you think that is? And for me, there's a couple of different explanations for that. The first potential explanation is that ChatGPT has some kind of guardrail in place to not generate pictures of children, to mitigate the kind of worst possible things you could imagine that people would do trying to generate images of children, which is a huge problem in this space. And the other potential explanation, and maybe these both exist at the same time, is that these models really just don't have good representative data about children. And so in that conversation we were just having about racism as a whole, I think we could also think about our society as being profoundly ageist and not giving young people full autonomy, agency, and power in this society. And that's also reflected in these models. And that's a really radical idea to think that we could live in a society where children are able to make decisions about our society, you know, in partnership with adults, or like across, you know, there's this cross-generational share of power in our society. And I think that's like a possibility, a future possibility that we might strive to give, you know, children who are so profoundly vulnerable in this society. Think of the worst harms that happen to children in this society. And like, what would it look like to have technology that reflects a world where children have real power?
So is that what your book is encouraging? In addition to the awareness, are you encouraging them to speak up and have a voice and be involved?
Absolutely. I think the most interesting activism that's happening in this space around AI harms and people pushing for regulation is actually being driven by young people. You know, organizations like Encode Justice and others like them are the ones writing the most interesting policy and doing the most interesting organizing on the Hill to like get people to care about these things.
Really?
Yeah, because they're the ones who are seeing it every single day firsthand.
Yeah, there's so much hope there. It's so scary, I feel like, for like my age and up. We're like, what do we do? But I guess they have a firsthand experience with it.
It's interesting. My daughter, she's a sophomore in high school, and her friends have such a negative reaction every time we mention ChatGPT. And I'm like, this is weird. Shouldn't you be embracing this? Are you noticing anything generationally around rejecting AI at all? I know that the kind of AI that's built into the technology, like, I don't think she thinks of the filters on her Snapchat as AI, right? But when she's thinking of engaging with this like machine and responding to it, she has such an adverse reaction. And I just wonder if that's, is that something that's happening generationally or just my kid?
That's a good question. I think it's happening in different pockets of the population across generations, like this algorithmic aversion, like people being like, not doing that. And, you know, again, there, some of the youth movements that I was just talking about have like the log off movement. It's young people encouraging other young people to just like get off of these platforms until the adults make them safe for us or safe for them. So I do think that there are pockets of young people who see that as a path forward, and I totally respect and support that. I think the other thing is that there still isn't, outside of these small pockets of young people, kind of a broader theory or like working model that young people can use to understand how this technology is affecting them on a daily basis. So like you said, like maybe they're critical of something like ChatGPT, but they don't fully understand how AI is being used in their doctor's office or is being used at the federal level to write policy and how those things may trickle down to impact their everyday life. And that's part of also why I wanted to write the book, to just be like, hey, there's AI all around you. And just because you don't see it
doesn't mean
that it's not impacting you.
Are you blaming AI for the title of the new bill, the Big Beautiful Bill? That's
blaming Trump. That sounds like a Trump title.
The tax bill is the big, no, yeah, Big Beautiful Bill.
I wouldn't be surprised if one of the Doge people was like, we're going to train a model on the way Donald Trump speaks, and then we're just going to use that to generate policy.
So I'm very jealous of the pledge that you're organizing at your kid's school and wish I had had the courage to do something. But for those of us who got suckered, I think you said either on air or off air, like how parenting is very sloppy. My oldest is a 14-year-old girl. And it's just a tricky line that we walk. We held out longest on Snapchat. But eventually it becomes this like tricky negotiations. So for those of us who are already, it's too late for our pledge. What should we know? What should we do? What should we be looking for our kid? Like I have two younger ones who aren't there yet. Mm-hmm. Now I have this one who is the role model for the other two. Like, what are ways as parents or caregivers or teachers or anyone who's engaging with these kids regularly that we can most effectively communicate with them if they are currently using social media?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't think teenagehood is about abstinence when it comes to technology, actually. I think we have to assume once our kids are teenagers that even if they're not on YouTube in our house, like they're going to a friend's house and they're getting on it, you know? So, and you know, this is like, as a progressive parent, this is how I would probably handle all kinds of those tricky topics like drugs and sex and all, you know, all the other things. So, you know, in adolescence, even early adolescence, the goal should be to help develop critical thinking around the use of technology, help them build self-regulation skills. So like, how can you encourage your teenager to check internally with what's happening, like what sensations they're feeling as they're on social media, and then set an internal threshold for themselves when it's time to get off because they feel the discomfort or the, you know, maybe it's like tightness in their chest that they feel after they've been on for too long. My 6-year-old, when we're watching cartoons, calls it like cartoon brain. Like, I feel cartoon brain. It's time for me to get off. And he'll turn off the cartoons and he'll go do something else.
Wow.
And so I think that, you know, that along with when you see something that's recommended to you online, maybe it's something on social media or something on the news, how can you verify if it's true? If it sounds like something that you've never heard before, what are the other places you should go check for information before you just accept that as truth? And so, you know, not my kid's not an adolescent, but we practice this too. It's like, okay, if you see something or somebody tells you something that doesn't sound true, like, I don't know, dinosaurs still exist, then he knows the first thing he should do is ask a grown-up. Right. And so those are the kinds of skills beyond just like taking the phone away from them, because when they get to college, when they're out in the world, they're, you know, they're going to have to navigate these tools.
Right. And I think that all of this AI is taking away my ability as well to critically think. So reintroducing that, because they have everything they need at their fingertips, critical thinking piece around technology.
Well, and beyond, I mean, this is the question I've really been wanting to ask. This is a show about intuition, about following your inner wisdom. That's why we call it Signal. Mm-hmm. So what can you tell us about how we can make sure that we as adults and we teach our kids how, I mean, you talked about checking with your body, which I loved, but is there anything else that you would say about making sure we're not losing access to that inner wisdom when we are externalizing our wisdom and seeing AI as being so wise? How do we hold on to our own wisdom as well?
Oof, what a good question. Yeah, I think I want to double down on like my somatic practices, like my somatic based ways of knowing if I'm in attunement or in alignment with my higher self are so important. And I'm trying to pass that on to my kiddo. And I will say the deeper I've gotten in my own somatic awareness, my own practices, the more agency I have felt with my own devices. Yes. Like I can be like, I'm not going to check social media for however many weeks. And then I'll get sucked into it somehow. Somebody will send me something and I'll start find myself scrolling. But I'm hyper aware now of how it like, you know, increases my heart rate or, you know, makes my body feel very different.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. I think that we have to be really careful to not spiritualize to a fault the technology.
Yeah.
And when I say that, I'm speaking very literally. There are folks who see ChatGPT as some like godlike, spiritual, all-knowing wisdom, source of wisdom. And to the point where folks are getting radicalized, like religiously radicalized, and believing it when it tells them that they are the future Messiah and that they need to cut everyone else off who doesn't see them as that. And, you know, ultimately these are prediction machines. They are like parrots. They're parroting back to us what has been fed to them at some amount of randomness so that it sounds plausible. And they're telling us what we want to hear so that we stay on the platforms longer. And, you know, we have to be very, very, very skeptical of that. Right. And I think there's some parallel there with like social media too, that, you know, this, the manifesting TikToks, the spiritual TikToks that will come to you and say, this is a message from, you know, your future self. And it's like, is it? Do I keep getting that because the algorithm knows I'll sit there and watch it and then I'm more likely to buy whatever the ad is next? Or, you know, so that's not to say that we, you know, we have to be completely, what's the word I'm thinking of? We have to like reject serendipity and that messaging and like, you know, guidance can't come to us from lots of different places. But it is to say that we should not feed into or believe the delusions that algorithmic systems send to us because there are ulterior motives there.
I asked it once. I got into this conversation with AI, with ChatGPT once about, I don't know, like spirituality or something. And I said, how do you know what God, what source or God is? And it said, I am a reflection of how you all have talked about this entity. And I am just gathering and summarizing and reflecting it back to you. That's my knowledge.
That's very self-aware, ChatGPT. Good job.
Right? I was like, okay, ChatGPT, thank you for your honesty. Yeah, wow. So fascinating. All right, well, listen, we could just talk to you all day. 100%. I have one final question. Bean, do you have a final question?
I really just wanted folks to be able to find Dr.
Yeah,
X.
That's going to be our last
question. That's going to be our wrap-up.
My final question for you is, what vision do you have for the world once they understand what it is that your work is out there to illuminate? What are you hoping for?
I really hope for a world where technology is put into the hands of folks at the margins who are motivated by a liberatory vision of the world, where all of us have our basic needs met, where we are all relating to each other in authentic, life-affirming ways, and where AI is not used to surveil and punish and limit the life outcomes of certain people because they just happen to have been born into a specific body at a specific time and place. And that's my grand vision. I can't get there by myself. The small number of us in a little corner of a field trying to work out these issues can't get there by ourselves. It is going to take lots of people with lots of different life experiences, at least having a basic understanding of how these technologies work in the society. And that's the step I'm on right now.
Beautiful. Well,
thank you for your work.
Go ahead. Ask your final question.
Oh, my question was, where can people find you? Where can people find the book?
Yeah. I am at avrialeps.com. You can buy the book there. The book is also being sold everywhere where books are sold. If your local indie bookstore doesn't have it, you can always go ask them to order it. And maybe order a couple copies and donate one to your local library.
Love that.
Make me so happy. And then I'm also on social media at King Avriel.
And her content is amazing and so edifying. I feel like I learned a lot. The book is called A Kid's Book About AI Bias. Go pick it up, read it with your kids, donate to libraries so more people can learn. Dr. Epps, thank you so much for your generosity of time and just every way that you helped enlighten us today. It was such a great conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
And listeners, we will be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. As always, if you learned anything or you're inspired, please, please, please share this with at least 2 people. Bean, I'll see you again in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.
Bye.
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 This has been another episode of Signal, the podcast that raises your frequency. This podcast is co-hosted and produced by myself, Maury Fontanez, and Melissa Bushka, and is edited by our sound editor, Josie Barak. Stay tuned next week for another episode.